Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, first in the studio today, we'll be joined by Heather DeFord. Heather is a physical therapist and has honed her practice to focus on the pelvic floor and pelvic therapy and jaw rehab at the Park City Medical Center. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Lynn. Then we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning author and New York Times reporter Jo Becker to discuss her newest book, Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality.
And that's a very timely discussion, although we did talk to Jo last week, very timely with all of the new movements in gay marriage.
And,
That's right. So stay with us. We'll be back right after this.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, today we're joined in the studio by physical therapist Heather DeFord. She's a specialist at the Park City Medical Center. She specializes in women's pelvic floors and also jaw rehab, not job rehab, jaw rehab, TMJ. And we're happy to have her here. It's a really interesting topic. It is a little personal, but what we find out is that many women out there, in fact, many more than ever admit, have issues with things like incontinence and prolapse, even at a very young age, in their 20s, and becoming younger and younger as we practice more sports that have a lot of impact. So, Heather DeFord, welcome, and thanks for being with us today on The Mountain Life.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I just think it's so interesting that you work on the pelvic floor or the pelvic area and the jaw. What are the parallels between those two areas?
Well, I was trained in Portland at a facility called Orthopedic TMJ, and the therapist there started working on the jaw, and due to the emotional center of the jaw, and the other, you know, they were women practitioners, they also started to realize the need for physical therapy in the pelvic floor. And we ended up seeing a lot of people who had jaw issues also had pelvic floor issues and vice versa. You know, there's nothing out there in research, but anecdotally, because they're both emotional centers, and then also if they're at the bottom and the top of the spinal column, they tend to mirror each other, and they are orthopedically kind of responsible and reflect each other.
What makes these two areas, and the one that kind of intrigues me the most is the jaw, what makes the jaw an emotional center or an energetic emotional center?
Right. It's a great question. If you ever felt angry and you check in with your jaw, it's usually very tight. Trying to balance a checkbook without clenching your jaw is a challenge for a lot of people. A lot of people clench their jaw at night, and that's a sympathetic overdrive that their body is not able to get into a deep rest place because they're still overplaying things in their, you know, from the day while they're sleeping.
Is that a different way of looking at the jaw and the pelvic area through this energetic connection? Because I know in your bio there you have a history of, you know, kind of what would be considered non-traditional practice. And I take it that's your interest in coming at it from a little different, you know, out of the mainstream and less traditional perspective.
Right. Well, I mean, I have been trained very traditionally. I have a master's in physical therapy, and I've gone to a lot of continuing education courses that are certified by the APTA, American Physical Therapy Association. And at the same time, yes, I do have an interest in energetic medicine. I believe that emotions play a part in someone's physical well-being. And the jaw and the pelvic floor, they're hidden muscles. They're not on the surface. And so when people go for a run, it's very easy to dissipate the stress in the rest of their body. But those areas are, you know, they're more tucked in. When I, you know, think about those muscles, they also have more, because of their, you know, the in of when you eat and then coming out, that also has a connection, you know, the in and the out of the body. And that has some energetic and emotional ties.
So a hypothetical person who is really relaxed overall could be very tense and tight in these two kind of hidden energetic areas.
Right. And I found that interesting. A lot of the time someone comes in and they seem calm and cool. And after the assessment, you realize, oh, wow, they do really have some deep-seated tension that is they're not even aware of.
Can you read that when you look at somebody? Can you go, oh, look at that jaw clench happening, and
sure.
that person doesn't even know it's happening?
Sure, yeah. sure.
The thing that I'm finding interesting as we're sitting here is that typically your jaw tightens, but a big issue with the pelvic floor is that the muscles aren't tight enough. They're flaccid, and that's what gives you things like prolapse and incontinence.
Right. Interestingly enough, someone who has a tight pelvic floor could have symptoms of prolapse or some sexual dysfunctions or even incontinence. And one of the reasons why, well, there's two main reasons. Because of the nerves, how they come out of the sacrum and innervate the pelvic floor, they could be constricted because of hip tension or infection, old fascia trauma from, you know, emotional trauma or surgeries. And if those nerves and, you know, blood flow doesn't have a clear passageway, then you might not have optimal function of the pelvic floor. That's one reason. The other reason is, as in anywhere in the body, a muscle needs to have its full range of motion. It needs to go from the, you know, starting position to the end position and be strong in all of those ranges. If someone has a tight pelvic floor and they're not able to completely relax the pelvic floor, then it's not as functional. And things like incontinence can still happen. It's very classic that someone comes in and they're having symptoms of incontinence or sexual dysfunction, and they say, I'm doing my Kegels, I don't know what's wrong. Why am I still having symptoms? Well, if they're not completely able to relax the muscle, then there's not going to be a functional pelvic floor.
Interesting. For those who are listening and are sitting there going, now, what exactly is the pelvic floor?
So if you think about your pelvis, and there's a hole in the bottom. The muscles of the pelvic floor are a hammock in between your sits bones and from your pubic bone to your tailbone.
Okay. And how many of those can be activated by doing a Kegel, which is to sort of squeeze if you were to, well, you should explain this because you're the medical professional.
Right. I've had some pretty funny interpretations of what a Kegel is. Just to start off the bat, all of you in here, if you were doing a Kegel, I shouldn't be able to tell.
I just did a Kegel.
Yeah, and I couldn't tell. I could not even tell. If someone starts raising up and down, or their thighs start clenching, or their jaw starts clenching, then you know that they're overcompensating and they're not just using their pelvic floor. And isolating it tends to be very important. A Kegel is easily described as stopping the flow of urine once you start it, or holding back gas. And I just want to stop right there and say, stopping and starting the flow of urine to exercise those muscles is not smart. You could really, you know, educate your pelvic floor to be overactive.
Okay. Let's talk about the kind of sexual dysfunction that you see with this. What would it be?
Well, pain with intercourse is a classic dysfunction of the pelvic floor. If those muscles are tight and have tension, and therefore the orifice is smaller. And at first, this is an insidious onset. At first, it's kind of not noticeable. Then over time, it becomes more and more noticeable. And I think the reason why is because the tissues on the surface tend to get irritated by the underlining muscle tension. Mm-hmm. And you can experience that anywhere in your body. If you have a tight neck and someone just sort of lightly touches your neck, you feel symptoms right on the surface. Mm-hmm. And then that can just sort of spiral out into a lot of other issues. Another one is just difficulty having an orgasm. If those muscles are tight and you don't have good neural innervation, then things just aren't functioning as well. Those muscles need to have enough flexibility and mobility to enjoy orgasm.
Okay. You know, this is a bit of a taboo subject, really.
Sure.
It's difficult to talk about on radio,
sure,
prime time. But we're talking about it anyway, because I think a lot of women experience this. And I've heard, especially those who practice sports when they're young and maybe they're in their 20s and they've been either volleyball players or gymnasts, things like that, where you're doing a lot of pounding. Is that where it comes from, or does it come just from childbirth?
yes and no and no and yes.
Well, let's not leave out aging.
Yes.
Sure.
Although you did say that young people get or have this condition as well.
Right. It really does affect people across the board. The impact sports, running, you know, trail running is very common, and that it is because of the pounding. You know, it's interesting. I've had women who've had four, you know, pregnancies, and they don't have any symptoms, and they've never done a Kegel in their life. And I've had one, you know, women who've never had a baby, and they have symptoms. So there's definitely some genetic components. There's also lifestyle components. You know, I've had enough clients, been doing this for over 10 years, and I've had a lot of clients in their older years say, why didn't I learn about this sooner? And I have that same question. I would love to get more information out there at a younger age. I'm working on that. In this young athletes education, I don't know how well they are educated in lifting their pelvic floor as part of their core. The pelvic floor is a core muscle. And if you are contracting your deep core muscles in your abdomen to support your back, really hope that your pelvic floor is on. It's almost as if squeezing a tube of toothpaste without putting the cap on. That cap is the pelvic floor. So, you know, it can happen for the younger population if they don't know how to activate it. But even if they do know how to activate it, it could be something in their genes.
Heather, we keep talking about women,
sure,
in this condition. Yeah, you knew this was coming, right? But there are a couple little giveaways in your bio or some of the stuff that I read. And I know that you're primarily focused on women's health, but mm-hmm, you do talk, or you make inferences to men with this condition as well. I mean, is it specific to women, or do you find men that have issues with pelvic floor?
Sure. You know, I've been doing this for 10 years, and I think I've had 5 male clients.
Now, is that because men don't have it as often, or is it because men aren't going to go to a doctor?
They don't
as
have
often?
It as they don't have it as often. It's the
or is it because men never ask for directions?
You know, I think it's because of the functional anatomy, because of the uterine, the birth canal is not as of a strong of a structure. And because men don't have that, it's just a different functional anatomy.
But you did make a reference to erectile dysfunction. So
sure,
there is sort of a...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've helped men with issues such as premature ejaculation and just pain with any sort of part of intercourse. And sometimes there's just deep hip pain in their, you know, sacral area or their low back that can get resolved by doing some of this work. You know, and because I specialize in the pelvic floor, therefore the pelvis and therefore the low back and the hips, balancing the pelvis orthopedically is crucial. So it's not, you know, it's not just about the muscles. It's about the joints that are all involved. And so someone who has chronic hip pain or back pain, pelvic floor physical therapy can become very crucial, man or woman.
And so is that, that's an alignment issue. That's a structural alignment issue.
Yes.
Do you get into, you know, structural realignment with your work, or do you
Absolutely.
Send people out to see chiropractors or do yoga, or, you know, how do you integrate that aspect?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, so I do joint manipulation, mobilization to help with the alignment. If I can't get it with the techniques that I know, then I definitely refer to some of my colleagues. And therapeutic exercise is always a part of it. Homework, someone doing their homework, everything from behavior modification to stretching to strengthening is all part of it.
And so by keeping your pelvic floor active and getting the full range of motion and then strengthening it to some degree, it's the connective element down there that can bring your pelvic, your whole pelvic area into proper alignment and help hold it there, mm-hmm. especially if you're stressing it during mm-hmm. these activities, mm-hmm. athletic activities like trail running that put a lot of stress on that
right.
area.
Right. One of my favorite ways to work in this field is when I get referrals from my colleagues, my other physical therapists who have been working with people. Maybe they even have had a knee surgery, or they had back surgery, or they have chronic pain in any of those areas, and they're not getting the results they want to. And they're tuning into their core, and they're realizing that's not really activated. They're having a hard time with that. And so, I will co-treat and help figure that out and problem solve. And, you know, if the pelvic floor then therefore is treated and it's cleared, meaning it's doing what it's supposed to be doing, you know, 9 times out of 10, their symptoms get better.
How do you know when it's doing what it's supposed to be doing? Is that something that you can, is that measurable?
Yes.
And do you have to go in and look, or do you get a sense from, you know, feeling and talking to somebody and working with them on Kegels and things of that nature?
Yes and yes. We use biofeedback and we use manual techniques to assess the pelvic floor, just like any other muscle in the body.
Okay, so what are the things that, if someone were to come and be evaluated by you and they've gone through the evaluation and you're getting them going on physical therapy, are they going to be using, STEM? Are they going to be using, what are some of the other immediate things that you would be doing in your treatment?
So like I mentioned, therapeutic exercise, behavior modification, and sometimes electrical stimulation is important. Sometimes biofeedback is important. It's a very individualized process. There really is not a cookbook, recipe. But a person would, expect to have homework. I touched on this before mm-hmm. is, if they're going to be coming to see a physical therapist for one time a week, they need to be doing all this other things to support and maintain the benefits. The other things that they can expect is body mechanic education and posture education. Tim said it, is that these muscles really are the core, and that is one of their major functions. There's 4 functions of the pelvic floor, and I think the structural component in holding up all the organs and maintaining balance with, between the hips and the back and the abdomen is crucial.
And is there a point with the people you treat that sometimes you say, well, there must be something else going on? I know a lot of times with surgery, they sort of sling up the bladder, mm-hmm. that's an actual, something. Can you determine?
Sure.
And can you determine that right away? Or does it all these other things didn't work that we tried, so it must be the bladder. It must be internally something
right.
going on.
That's an individual process. Some people don't have the time or the energy to go through the homework and, the 3 months of exercise and physical therapy to try to heal it themselves. And they, want to go straight to a surgery, and that's completely valid. And then sometimes people have surgeries and they're still having symptoms.
If you don't have a pelvic floor that is, in good working conditions and you get surgery, might the surgery not work?
I have seen that, and especially in my older population, when they say it helped a little bit for some years, and then it didn't anymore. Mm-hmm. My ideal would be if someone even was going to have a surgery, that they would still go in for PT to set them up for success. Just much if you're going for total knee or total hip, you have pre-physical therapy, so you learn the exercises so that you're more successful after.
Right. I still go back to, it used to be that women would have 13 children. Now we have few. We mm-hmm. have 2 or 3 mm-hmm. or 4. Mm-hmm. Why is it? Is it just that we're talking about it more and we're realizing it's an issue? It always was an issue, but
yeah,
I mean, 13
I've had
kids.
Sure. I've had a lot of clients in their older years say, I just thought that was part of it. I just thought that was part of being a woman, part of being a mom. Huh. And I do think that I don't know for sure, but because women are having children later in life, that might also play a part in, maybe more of an increase. But I honestly think that there's studies out there that there's less people, there's less talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So Heather, somebody comes in and maybe somebody who listens to this program and they say, wow, I need to go, work on this. I need to see Heather and see what's happening with me. What is kind of your sense of your success rate with people who come in and you give them, you know, a program to follow and you see some improvement? I mean, obviously they have to stick with it. You know, there has to be a dedication and some tenacity and consistency to this. So, but let's say that person has all those things. I mean, you know, is there a good chance that you can help them, or do you see, you know, times where there's just not much that can be done?
Absolutely. I think that there's, I definitely have helped people. I think there's, I would say 8 out of 10 of a success rate where the symptoms are completely resolved.
And does that cover a spectrum of symptoms? I mean, from, you know, the worst, and I'm sure there are cases that are worse and some that are better, some that are easier to deal with and some that are more challenging. But, I mean, even the whole spectrum, it's not like if you're at the far end where it's really a challenging situation, you have no hope.
Right. Even in those situations, I've seen improvement, yet someone needs to go on and, you know, use medication or have a surgery or use, you know, there's more options out there besides just pharmaceuticals and surgeries. There's things like pessaries or using, you know, electrical stimulation. I mean, there's more steps to the process, and it really is an individual basis. And that's one of the things that I, you know, pride myself on, is that I meet the person where they're at. I don't have an agenda. It's really what they are interested in doing. And I think that if someone has the tenacity and consistency, they have a much better chance. And I've seen a lot of success, and it's not only with the incontinence and sexual dysfunctions, but I mean, I've helped people with chronic constipation or serious menstrual cramps or symptoms. And basically it's just clearing the area of congestion and even fertility issues.
Now, did I see that you're affiliated with the Wellness Center, or am I making that up? Are you affiliated, you know, under the Department of Physical Therapy or Wellness? Where do you fit in at the medical center?
I'm a physical therapist. So I'm part of the Park City Physical Therapy at the hospital up here. The Wellness Center, I have relations, you know, with them, and we send patients back and forth. And, you know, there's going to be an expansion there where the Live Well Center is going to be part of the physical therapy department. And we're excited about that for more crossover and assistance.
We like the Live Well Center, don't we, Tim?
We do. I especially like it. You got the award for most social and likable, but I got the award for
most fit.
Most well.
least amount of body fat for a really old guy. Okay. Very good. Well, that just made me forget my next question. it's always about that competition. Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about the emotional component. We started off by talking about that. Mm-hmm. So whether it's your pelvic floor or your jaw, what do you do there? Or again, do you, you know, send people out to talk, you know, to a therapist or something like that?
Mm-hmm. I do a lot of parasympathetic training. The parasympathetic system is responsible for resting and digesting. It's the time in your nervous system where you can heal the best. And so I do a lot of behavior modification and giving people real easy ways that they can decrease the amount of emotional stress that gets caught in their body. So I'm still really working on the physical, emotional plane. And I definitely refer out if it's beyond that scope. Mm-hmm. If people need more assistance with, you know, psycho-emotional, or if they've had trauma in the past that is unresolved.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't operate alone in that.
So I am one of those people who clenches while I sleep. In fact, when I'm concentrating just at my desk here, I find that my jaw tightens. Mm-hmm. And so what are a few things that you tell people right off about how to relax your jaw? I mean, it's hard to just relax. Just
especially
relax
at night if you're sleeping or something like that, and you do that jaw clench, which I know is a symptom that a lot of people deal with, and they wear mouth guards and everything.
I have a mouth guard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I use stickers. I ask people for two reasons. So I'm giving away some of my pearls. So if you come to see me, you won't have to pay for the first session, because this is basically what we go over in
the
first session.
Bring your stickers in your hand.
So when I'm at home playing with my girls, I put stickers on my cheeks, right by my jaw, and on my forehead, kind of where my third eye is. And that's a cue because I can feel it. If I start to furrow my brow or clench my jaw, there's a tactile cue right there. Then the other thing I give my clients is stickers to sort of decorate their life. I ask them to put it on their water bottle, their cell phone, their dashboard mirror in the kitchen, by the in the bathroom and the kitchen sink, so that every time they see that, it's a reminder to check in. What's my posture doing? What's my breath doing? And I really hone in on the breath. There's a lot of breath work. I've had some really fun training in breath work, because doing a diaphragmatic breath will move your nervous system from the sympathetic drive, the stress mode, to the parasympathetic drive, the rest and digest mode. So the more often you can access that parasympathetic drive, you will have less overdrive when you sleep. So it's training. And of course, doing some relaxation training before you go to bed, just to sort of down train and relax the system. You know, the theory is that there will be less overdrive while you're sleeping.
That's interesting. It's all great. So you can be found at the Park City Medical Center. And here's an important question. If you have any of these symptoms that you'd like to have help with, can you just make an appointment? Do you need a referral from a doctor usually to have your insurance cover it?
Right. Great question. I don't need to have a physician referral, except sometimes insurance companies do. So what we always tell people is, if you want to go through your insurance, because sometimes it's not the best way because of high deductibles these days, and if you do pay out of pocket, you get a great discount at the time of service. And that way you don't need any sort of physician referral. But if you do want to go through your insurance, then you just need to get a physician referral.
Okay. And you, the physicians that you work with at the Park City Medical Center on these questions, you know, regarding incontinence and prolapse and sexual dysfunction are whom?
Well, at IHC, there's Dr. Falk, Dr. Sabella, Dr. Monday is the urologist. But, you know, really, it's women talking to women is where I find that most women find me. But, you know, on all the doctors around town, I mean, hopefully they know about these services by now. But, you know, any primary care physician can refer. It doesn't need to be any specialist.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, what did we miss? We must have missed something interesting. Let's talk about men some more.
Well, we passed right over that. If you're, the clenching is like if you're trying to clench your urinary tract or stop gas. And I noticed you didn't allow me to delve into that topic.
Go right ahead.
That one caught my attention, but
for sure, for sure. I mean, there's, you know, for when sometimes men who need to have their prostate removed, or if they have prostatitis, which is inflammation of the prostate, there's a whole protocol for men to get some resolution in that, and they've been able to reverse the prostatitis, the inflammation of the prostate, by doing this type of work. In Stanford, there's a WISE protocol. WISE is the doctor's name, and it's using trigger points to help relieve the tension in that. I know a lot of pelvic floor physical therapists who treat half women, half men. It just kind of depends on the demographics. And if you're next to a center that specializes in it, then those centers need physical therapists, you know,
so
close by.
Do you do the trigger point work?
Yes. I've been trained in it, yes.
Okay, that's interesting. So those, yes. I know in our aging population here, I know some people who take medication for an enlarged prostate.
Right.
So before you take medication, come and do the work and the trigger point stuff.
Yeah, and it also could be something, it'd be an adjunct. You take the medication. Even saw palmetto is a over-the-counter tincture. It's an herb that has been very successful in decreasing the rate of inflammation. But getting some herbal or pharmaceutical help and doing the trigger point work is the best scenario.
Okay. All very interesting, and you talk about it in such an educated fashion, and it makes it so it doesn't feel like taboo to talk about.
That wasn't embarrassing at all.
No,
it wasn't. Well, Heather DeFord, physical therapist at the Park City Medical Center, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And if someone wants to find you, they call, what, 658-7000?
That's the general hospital number, and that will eventually get you to where I'm at. But the direct number to the physical therapy department is 435-658-7350.
Okay, very good. Thanks so much for your time today.
All right,
we appreciate
thank you.
It. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Be back. We'll be right back with Jo Becker. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter. She's written a book recently released called Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and I'm excited to announce that the Intermountain Park City Bonanza Clinic will now be a full-time InstaCare. For your ongoing medical needs, you'll see our partners at the Intermountain Park City Clinic at Round Valley. For your fractures, lacerations, and urgent care needs, come by and see us at the Bonanza InstaCare, 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, president of Grand Valley Bank, Frontier Branch in Park City, a proud supporter of KPCW. Our team can help you with all of your banking needs, from deposit accounts to business lending. We have one branch in Park City and two branches in Heber and Midway, Heber Valley Bank. GrandValleyBank.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Big air, big skills, big fun. Catch the Flying Ace All-Star Freestyle Show this summer at the Utah Olympic Park. Every Sunday at 1 p.m., the All-Star athletes showcase spectacular aerial talent into the Olympic aerials pool. Watch as they soar up to 60 feet in the air performing acrobatic feats. During the month of July, additional shows will be available every Saturday at 11 a.m. For show tickets and more, go to UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Our next guest, Jo Becker, is an award-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the New York Times. She's written a new book called Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality. It's a very timely discussion, but she takes us through the history, a riveting legal drama. It's a snapshot in time when the gay rights movement altered course and public opinion really shifted with the speed of a bullet train. This is said to be Becker's most remarkable accomplishment, how she weaves a spellbinder of a tale that, despite a finale reported around the world, manages to keep readers gripped until the very end, from Proposition 8 to some of the legal battles going on right now around the country with the overturning. It seems like each week we hear of a new state where the ban on gay marriage has been overturned. Now, we spoke with Jo Becker last week before this most recent development in Utah, this week with Judge Kimball ordering the state to recognize those gay marriages that took place over the 17-day period in December and January. We're very pleased to have spoken with Jo Becker. Jo Becker, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
Jo Becker, I think that maybe if we start, because so many Americans now, as we're in the crux of this house of cards falling, really, with it seems like each week a new state is overturning the ban on same-sex marriage. Maybe you can give us a little history, starting by going back to when Proposition 8 passed in California in 2008. And just start us off there with what led up to that.
Sure. I mean, look, one of the things I write about in the book is the long and really sordid history of discrimination against LGBT citizens in this country. I mean, it's hard to believe that, you know, they were once sort of, you know, hunted down in bars, arrested, they couldn't serve in the federal government. It's a pretty sordid history. This story picks up in 2008 with the passage of Proposition 8. Proposition 8, of course, was California's ban on same-sex marriage. What no group of citizens in this country have been targeted more that, by ballot initiatives than gays and lesbians. And with the passage of Proposition 8, they were 0 for 30 at the ballot box. And at the time, there was only, I mean, it's hard to cast back. It's only 5 years ago. There were only two states with same-sex marriage, and the majority of Americans were opposed. Of course, now there are 17 states with clear majority of Americans approve, and there are, you know, just a slew of these lawsuits. But at the time, you know, the fear was in bringing a constitutional challenge of the sort that was brought in California was that they would lose, that the country wasn't ready, that the court wasn't ready. And so, you know, the strategy was that they were going to kind of move state by state. Of course, in a state like Utah, which I visited earlier this last year, you know, change was certainly not going to come probably in Utah anytime soon at the ballot box. And the feeling was the story starts with a young Hollywood Democratic political consultant named Chad Griffin, who of course now is the head of the Human Rights Campaign. And he's watching these returns come in, and he's just like feeling gut punched and thinking, if we can't win in California, I mean, the left coast, like, where can we win? And so, you know, shortly thereafter, he was with his friends and kind of almost parental figures, the Reiners. Rob Reiner, of course, the movie director who directed movies like When Harry Met Sally. And they're sitting in the Polo Lounge in California in Hollywood, and they are just commiserating, and they think, you know, we've got to try something different. And just then, in one of the kind of many serendipitous moments in the book, a friend of theirs came over and sort of said, well, you know, long story short, heard what they were talking about and said, well, you ought to talk to my ex-brother-in-law. You know, he's a constitutional lawyer, and I think he'd be with you on this issue. And they said, who is that? And they said, well, Ted Olson. And they're, you know, everybody's jaw kind of dropped because Ted Olson was this guy liberal loved to hate. He had won Bush v. Gore deciding the disputed 2000 presidential election for Bush. But both Rob Reiner and Chad, sort of immediately saw the kind of headline-grabbing potential of that and thought, if a guy as conservative as Ted Olson could embrace this cause, it was game-changing. It had the potential to really shift the conversation.
Joe, taking that concept of the constitutionality of this issue that drew somebody like Ted Olson to the side of gay rights, it's the same theme that I've kind of tried to understand and get my head around. It's by calling it gay rights, it almost derails or redefines, and you talk about rebranding that has to be done to appeal to certain justices, but it almost kind of takes it away from just a straight up, and no pun intended, but a straight up discussion on equality. And
That's right. And I think, look, you've seen a remarkable evolution in this country over the last 5 years. The evolution was orchestrated very carefully. And what happened was, you know, once this sort of headline-grabbing lawsuit, you know, with featuring not just Ted Olson, but the guy who fought him on the other side, David Boies of Bush v. Gore, you know, started getting going, a very relentless kind of accompanying public education campaign went along with that lawsuit. And the idea was to stop talking about this. Don't talk about it as gay rights. Talk about it in terms of American values. Talk about it in terms of civil rights. And, you know, one of the sort of details of sort of how they did that, but I find it like a really good one. I was in the war room, the political war room, and on the days before the first day of the trial. And there were these boxes kind of lining the war room. And I said, what's in the boxes? There were 2,000 American flags. And they were to be handed out at the rally that was going to take place on the opening day of this kind of historic federal trial. And they wanted the imagery not to be of, you know, the rainbow flag connotating gay rights, right? They wanted it to be American flags.
And so you talk about the shift in the collective view and the support that was against and then quickly came about to be in favor of. Was that part of, I mean, obviously it was part of the orchestrated campaign that went hand in hand with what was happening in the courts. And that's unprecedented, is it not, for to have that happen, that shift happen on such a large scale in such a short period of time.
Yes, there's been nothing in modern American political history to equal the rapidity of this shift. The book is called Forcing the Spring, and the title somewhat ironically comes from President Bill Clinton's first inaugural speech, and he talked about in that speech, you know, this ceremony takes place in the depth of winter, but by our words, by our deeds, we force the spring. Change was coming. If you look at the demographics of this issue, young people don't even understand why we're debating it. So change was coming. The question was how fast. And what this group decided to do is try to give it a jump start.
And now that you can sort of see the wave and the tsunami is breaking on the shore, are the political opponents, and I don't even want to, talk about what party or, what affiliation and all that, but are the opponents from the political arena starting to, massively flee the wave? I mean, they must see what's coming. And to be aligned with the wrong side of this argument that has shifted so quickly from a political standpoint must be committing Harry Caray.
Well, I don't know about that. What I do know is that I talked to Maggie Gallagher, for instance, who founded the organization, the National Organization for Marriage, which has, fought to stop same-sex marriage. And she said, that they've lost the war of public opinion. In the book, she talks about, she just can't even, she can't even get her message out unless we pay for advertising anymore. It's just been a remarkable shift, and what an interesting stat to consider: one out of four Americans who now support marriage equality used to think the other way. So people's minds have been changed, and one of the reasons that they've been changed is because they come to know somebody who is gay. 9 out of 10 Americans now say they know someone who's gay, and that changes things. It changes, one of the most remarkable things in the book is the lawyer on the other side who fought these plaintiffs that I write about all the way to the Supreme Court talked about how listening to their testimony impacted him and how it made him understand what an excruciatingly difficult political issue this is. His legal views remain unchanged, but politically, he's sort of shifting. And then he comes to find out midway through the case that one of his children, his stepdaughter, Ashley, is a lesbian. And he told me, when he saw Chris and Sandy get married, this is the kind of power of stories, right, and storytelling. When he saw them get married after listening to their testimony, even though he fought them all the way to the Supreme Court, that he could not help but rejoice in their happiness. Wow. And he is now planning the wedding of his daughter, who is getting married in June in Massachusetts, with a lot of joy.
Hmm. Joe, I'm wondering, as this surmounts even being a political issue and is really just a human issue, there are still those stalwarts. And, since you mentioned the state of Utah and since we're here, let's talk a little bit about Utah and how you see the state and the Mormon Church shifting its view. As we know, the Mormon Church was very much implicated in the passage of Proposition 8. And I'm just wondering how you see that shift.
Yeah, sure. Like many denominations, the Mormon Church is grappling with this issue. Why are they grappling it? Primarily because they have people who go to church who are faithful who may themselves be gay, or they have children who are gay, and they're trying to find more compassionate sort of ways to talk about this, and more Christ-like ways of talking about this. And the Mormon Church is no longer in the business of funding initiatives. They were a huge and very important funder, not just a funder, but a provider of foot soldiers in the battle over Proposition 8. They're out of that business now. Utah, I describe it in the book in many ways, is sort of the Montgomery, Alabama of this movement. I don't think that Utah is a place that politically you're going to see change. And that is the argument for going to the federal courts, because while 17 states from 2 when I started now have same-sex marriage, I think it's probably safe to say that it won't be coming there anytime soon if it's just a matter of politicians voting on it. Or, it has to be done by the courts.
And then, you know, taking this a step further, maybe away from a religious issue, there are those who remain steadfast. And it's interesting because my parents are an example of this. They're very progressive. They could care less about, you know, who wants to be with whom. But they are these steadfast constitutionalists, I guess I would say, which is a little strange. And they bring up that argument that it's this slippery slope about, you know, if you change this provision of the Constitution and redefine these certain things that are the basis of our Constitution, where do we go from there? What do you think about that?
Right. Well, I think that the argument is on the other side of that is that this isn't changing the Constitution, that the Constitution has always contained this right, that there is a fundamental right to marry that the Supreme Court has ratified 16 different times, I think. I might be slightly wrong on that number, but thereabouts. I mean, they have affirmed the right of deadbeat dads to marry. They have affirmed the rights of felons to marry. You know, so this is a fun. The argument is that this is a fundamental right, and the debate is over. Well, how do you define the right? Is it the right to marry the person that you love? Or is it just the right to marry someone of the opposite sex? And that's what this whole trial was about, and I hope your readers will read the book and make their own decisions about that.
And Joe, when you're talking about fundamental rights, and I mean, over time, don't fundamental rights become reflected in the law? Isn't that where the law goes?
Well, sure. I mean, look, the
and I mean, maybe it takes more time than any of us thinks it should. But isn't that where it eventually ends up?
Well, this country has always edged inexorably towards greater inclusion, and that's the history and the wonderful history of our country. Sometimes it takes longer than others. Sometimes the court makes mistakes that it will then, you know, later correct. But, you know, I think that most people look at this Supreme Court and with its makeup, and they don't see how five justices who handed down the kind of, you know, beautifully written opinion that they did in the Windsor case, which is the case that challenged
right.
DOMA, which was a law that defined marriages between a man and a woman for the purpose of doling out federal benefits, and they decided the case that really is at the heart of my book on a kind of more technical grounds, which allowed same-sex marriages to resume in California, meaning a fifth of the country, you know, could suddenly get married. But, you know, I know you've got your case out there. I mean, that case is barreling back towards the Supreme Court. They're going to have to decide this issue. And I think that most people believe, anyhow, that Justice Kennedy, who I've done a lot of reporting on in this book as well, that Justice Kennedy and the four other justices who voted to strike down DOMA are not going to turn around and uphold bans like the one in Utah. And I think that what's very interesting is to date, not one federal court who has considered this issue has come to a different conclusion.
Mm. And I believe it was Justice Kennedy with the Edie Windsor case who was, you know, the tiebreaker. And it seems like he has been pushed into this, or he has selected for himself to be in that position on quite a few cases. But do you think when Utah's case comes back to the Supreme Court, is he going to be that same person, or has the tide shifted enough that there won't be a tiebreaker?
Well, it's tough to say. I mean, you know, I also think that it's pretty unlikely, given the tenor of the argument, that at least three of the four justices would opposed on the losing side of that Windsor case would suddenly say, yes, it's true, same-sex couples do have a constitutional right to marry. I doubt that that's the case. I still think it's probably going to be 5-4. But you never know, because Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice, very aware of the court's place in history and his own place in history, left himself a little wiggle room, so possible. I wouldn't bet on it, but it's possible.
Well, Joe, that brings up an interesting thought and question, which is, if you have this fundamental truth that maybe is reflected in personal views. And you talked about Charles Cooper, how his personal views had shifted through the interviews and the depositions and his experience with the court. And so you have personal views that sort of align with a fundamental truth or a right. And then you have the views of these justices and people involved in the battle that their legal opinion is misaligned with their personal view and the fundamental right. And here you have it on the Supreme Court. And what's driving that? Is that, are people trying to get somewhere or are people being pushed somewhere? Where does fear and risk calculation play into the process of what the Supreme Court is dealing with?
Like, one of the things that I write about in my book and I found really fascinating is, you know, there's so much fear of the Supreme Court, right? You know, you have in my book, it was sort of Ted Olson bringing this case and on behalf of four plaintiffs. And he really was confident. He really felt there were five votes, but a lot of people didn't. It was very controversial when he brought that case. It was the first federal lawsuit of its kind to reach the Supreme Court. And there was a lot of people with a lot of fear at the outset. One of the things I think is interesting is, like, these lawyers, you know, you think of the Supreme Court as kind of immune and they just look at the law, et cetera. But, you know, these lawyers are aware every step of the day of everything that they say. Everything they say is calculated to appeal to those justices, and they get very worried if anybody goes off script or in any way offending the justices. I mean, you'd think that these justices were real delicate flowers, the way the lawyers sort of are so cautious.
Right. The book is Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality. Jo Becker, thank you so much for your time today. We hear your other phone ring.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Again, that was Jo Becker with Forcing the Spring, Inside the Fight for Marriage Equality, an interesting conversation. Apparently, the book is seeing quite a lot of controversy.
And even from some corners that you wouldn't expect it, a lot of the controversy seems to be coming from the pro-equality side as opposed to the fundamental religious and conservative side, which is interesting. I'm not sure, but they feel like there was some criticism or some concerns brought to how they were pushing this initiative, and they're taking offense at that.
Ah,
yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, we will be right back after these words from our underwriters. This is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. Stay with us.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, ParkCityNursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. Low Stump Tree Service, Park City's local tree care, 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Of course, you can access archived Mountain Life shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab and Mountain Life. And we'd like to thank our guest, Jo Becker, and also Heather DeFord from Park City Medical Center and our underwriters.
San Francisco Design, Prudential Utah Real Estate, Park Meadows Country Club, our new sponsor, Vinto, City Clinic, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, and of course, Grand Valley Bank.
Mm-hmm. And thanks to Vinto for signing on. I had lunch there just yesterday. A very delicious lunch, I might add. Oh, the leftovers I have in the fridge here. Yes.
Cold pizza.
There we go. And it's time now for news. This is KPCW Park City.